Hello, and welcome to Cycle Systems Academy podcast. Now, we've got a few early editions of podcast, which sadly we lost. And one of them was an interview with one of the founders of mountain biking, someone who put a word in the dictionary, Mr. Gary Fisher. So we had to get him back on. So Gary, welcome back to the Cycle Systems Academy podcast.
Well, thanks. And I'm sad to hear about your tragedy that you lost it. It was like you had it digitized. And what happened?
It was what happened is we changed the people who host our podcasts. And somehow the old hoster, the file had got corrupted. So we lost about the first 18 episodes or so. So just like the Buddhists say, everything arises and everything passes. And that particular stream of consciousness has passed. So I would expect everyone listening to the Cycle Systems Academy podcast knows that you're one of the inventors of the mountain bike, one of the founding fathers of everything mountain biking, and I've probably seen the film Clunkers, you know, which documents that scene. But you have got a new book coming out, you know, so Being Gary Fisher, it is just about to hit the shelves. So what can people expect in here?
Well, to be honest, I mean, it's a big fat book. It's bound in a peculiar manner. Every single page is not white with black printing at all. Every single page has been designed. You know, it's crazy. These guys, the artists, went nuts. And I let them go crazy. And they brought a lot of other people in, a lot of volunteers. And I scanned a ton of stuff that I had that was a ton of photographers that I've met over the years, like just pulled out stuff that nobody's ever seen. So it like got away from me. It's a lot more than just me. I've been working on this almost 4 years now. It's crazy. And it's starts, you know, 110 years ago. And it goes through my early cycling life, which I started in, you know, 62, riding road and track. And my first cross race was in 64. And I was a kid. I was a little kid, as you know, and not even 98 pounds. I was 89 pounds when I first started racing. And my father took a ton of great photos back then, all black and white. He even published in the cycling magazine at the time, which was a local called Northern California Cycling Association newsletter, which eventually became a bicycling magazine. How do you like that? I did work for Bicycling Magazine for 8 years as a road tester, which was a lot of fun in the 70s. I got free bikes to ride all the time. Anyway, that's sort of my stuff. I go into my grandfather, worked for Warner Brothers for 40 years, you know, worked on the sets and really invented a thing called the script supervisor. And when they went from silent movies to sound movies, which is a big technological thing, my grandfather was a big part of that and worked with a lot of the famous actors of the time for Warner Brothers, and a lot of the better, you know, did films like Treasure of the Sierra Madre, you know, Captain Blood, you know, Lolita, you know, Stanley Kubrick's film. He did a lot of that stuff, take me out on a set, went to opening day at Disneyland, all this crazy stuff. Yeah. We go through that, and then my life, you know, the cycling, and then I did meet a rock and roll band a lot of people have heard of called the Grateful Dead, and I ran away from home and lived with those guys for about 4 years, and some of those adventures, because there are a lot of them, and I did light shows at a lot of the venues in San Francisco. I had 10 people in a show. It was all analog, liquids, 16 millimeter film, 35 millimeter film, you know, slide projectors, and everything was heavily modified. And that was, you know, a short period of time. I had a big adventure with that, and then jumped back into the bike racing. And I was a road racer, and I love bike racing. God, if I could bike race for the rest of my life, I would. So, you know, I think it's the thing I miss the most is I don't have the cards anymore, the horsepower to go out and lay down 400 watts. You know, I love watching bike racing, you know. So I watch the road race. It's been like spectacular the last couple of months, and the mountain bike, you know. What's been done there is at Red Bull with the technology side is amazing, you know, that they've made cross country mountain biking something you'd actually want to watch on television, you know, between the video, how they handle, you know, the showing of it and everything. And the courses, you know, the courses are amazing now. I mean, you know, it's a total technology, you know, that's something I've gotten involved in a lot of urban, you know, bikeway stuff and all that. And, you know, taking back space from cars, which have been thoroughly inefficient, have failed on promise and created massive crushing death and death by fine particulate, all proven now. And it's time for them to end their reign on the premier right-of-ways. I mean, they have to give it up because they have failed to actually get people there, you know. And in the U.S. it's 1.3 passengers per car is a national average. And when you look at the size of a car, how much space it takes up, it's like, this is a mathematical like stupidity. You know, that coupled with the health crises, you know, that we're still, you know, number one is cardiovascular disease is claiming people. You know, we got to do something, and we do have the solution. So I'm into that like crazy, but lately, I've realized the guys doing the mountain bike tracks, things like the Red Bull Rampage, they use algorithms, wheel size, wheelbase, speed, velocity, ramps, things. It's like you ride a really well-designed mountain bike trail now. That and you can feel like a genius, and you'd be flying, you know. And they're not that hard; they're safe, you know. These guys got to get integrated into urban design, and that is, they know they design in 3D, you know, whereas like a lot of the urban designers are doing it in 2D, and it's sort of a political game for a lot of the urban designers, you know. And you know, a lot of we go back to the solution. The major solution for a lot of urban designers is going back to what I was talking about before, is reclaiming the vital, the best right-of-ways to say, hey, look, we want to go direct. You guys have failed. You failed in this way, that way, this way. We're going direct. And this is the plan. And making a plan that is significant, that is not piecemeal, that is not what we call squirrel nuts, but a plan that would deliver. Because what you need to do is pencil in a whole setup like this and do something aggressive instead of something that'll make a big difference. Something that'll make somebody feel like, I mean, have the confidence that they can get around everywhere and get there rather quickly on a bike or walking. You know, and I think, you know, I love to walk as well. You know, I think it's such a incredibly convenient thing. And then in the transport, you know, the micro mobility thing. One of the things that's blowing my mind, I mean, I'm a California kid. I was 14 years old. I was on a skateboard team. I can skate, you know. If you live in the Midwest, all those people you see them on rollerblades, they're really good because everybody ice skated, you know. And it's really funny. In a lot of cities, like in San Francisco, I'll see people on electric skateboards and the one wheels. And the one wheels are amazing. They can go over all types of crappy pavement. They really blow my mind. And, you know, I'm out riding my bike around here early in the morning. I'll start out at like 6 a.m., 5:30. And there's this guy, you know, on his electric skateboard. It's dark. He's flying along at like 25 miles an hour. He's in a three-piece suit, you know, and he's got a little backpack on it, and it's a longboard. And I'm like motor pacing this guy to skateboard, and he does about a mile and a half. He stops. I stop, check him out, and he puts the skateboard in the backpack, jumps on the bus, and goes to work with his briefcase. He's like Superman, you know, and it's not the first time I've seen this, you know, because the charm of a skateboard, big wheel, is that you pick it up and you go inside a modal, is you know, you go in a cab, you go in somebody's car, you put it inside the restaurant, it's right there next to you, you don't worry about it, you know. So there's that whole level, and then there's the electric bike, of course, is because I'll tell you, I mean, electric skateboard, I'm not going to do that, man. It's too scary for me. But it blows my mind how many I see. It just, it's something.
It's so cool to see them at night, isn't it? With the big headlight coming out the front of the board, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The new scooters, you know, that use pneumatic tires and everything are, you know, a fairly long wheelbase, good brakes. They still haven't made a really good scooter yet, you know, they're getting there. Mm-hmm. They go pretty good, you know, they get you around really nice. And, you know, the key thing is they don't take up that much space really, you know, but, I like, then there comes this, you know, the shared vehicles, which tend to, they have a different, it's a different animal than having your own. And you go to the sort of the other extreme is like the cargo bike. And I've got a cargo bike here, an electric cargo bike. And it's essential, you know, when you got kids and you want to do shopping or something like that. It's always been the fastest way to get around town. Absolutely. And get stuff done. You know, that's like coming on like crazy. I think every bike maker is going to start making one of those. You know, that I keep hearing around about, oh yeah, we're working on that.
We're doing, I mean, they've become mainstream, right? I mean, when we started doing the stuff in London, we used freight bikes, you know, and I had a freight bike as my main bike around London.
Right.
So, yeah. And now it's got to the point where there's a freight bike share scheme in London. So you need an electric freight bike for a day or what have you, or an hour, you've got it. And I for one, would definitely live in a city designed by Brandon Semenuk. Absolutely. So I love that about the 3D algorithms of the Red Bull guys. That's amazing. Awesome vision, Gary.
That's the thing, is that, you know, you've got to, you know, to develop yourself as a human being, you know, you got to keep pushing things. And man, the kids today are good, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you do it right, you know, that stuff is relatively safe. You know, and it's the old thing, you know, or the route to school where like you get the feature and you get the go around, you know. Mm-hmm. There's no dishonor on doing the go around, you know. If you got to do the go around and you work your way up to things, it's always about a challenge and a chance. You got to have a challenge, but you need to have a chance. So it needs to be progressive and everything. So it's your groups, you know. It's like, I remember we did a Trek World meeting in Paris at the Velodrome. And we hung out at, the velodrome for like 5 days. And I was riding the velodrome, and I met the organizers, and one of the greatest nights they have there is a women's night, you know? And like, this just, that's what it is. A velodrome is all about the events you do. Like, a velodrome can't survive without a great promoter that can put on different events. And events these days, they got to be, you know, you got to have all levels. And one of the big level, big things is participatory, and, you know, people that can do stuff there, you know, and everyone gets to ride, everyone gets to have a good time. So that's important, you know. It's all parts of the pyramid have got to be in place, you know, the whole thing.
Well, all of this really fits into the subtitle of your book. So the book is called Being Gary Fisher, and the subtitle is And the Bicycle Revolution. So this, you know, I guess is a reference to the mountain bike, which revolutionized the bike world, but also your roots in the radical 60s and the Grateful Dead. And I was really fascinated to talk about these concepts with you because, you know, I'm a child of the 70s. I was born in the 70s, you know, so the 60s kids were my parents' generation. And I was reading Armageddon Rag by George R.R. Martin recently, and it's a really great book all about the 60s and the music and the culture. And it made me sad reading it. I read it about 9-10 months ago because it really reinforced the spirit of optimism. Right. You know, the baby boomers, the 60s, like, we can change the world. We are changing the world. Compared to now, where we're living with Trump and with Brexit and with climate change really hitting, and the kind of dark nihilism, you know. But yeah, then what happened?
I spent time with four-year period. It was amazing. Like, I met I used to sit around the table with the Grateful Dead.
Yep.
You know, with Jerry Garcia a lot. I hung out with him a lot. And Jack Leary, Timothy's son, a lot. Jack Leary was there all the time. Timothy Leary was there, and Ken Kesey. And I spent time on Ken Kesey's farm. I mean, I built a geodesic dome one day with Ken Kesey. And I mean, doing nitrous oxide with Ken Kesey, Jerry Garcia, all these people like that, they were normal people to me, you know? And I hung out when I was like 17, 16. I ran away from home. I hung out with these guys. I worked for the airplane, you know, the Jefferson airplane, in their mansion, did their whole Bill Graham, you know, Carousel Ballroom, you know, was up on the ranch where we made orange sunshine, you know, Altamont. Yep. Oh my God. I was like part of that, you know. I watched the whole thing go from organization, grand dream, to like total freaking nightmare. And I have photos of it in the book and things of stuff I took there. But I got out of it alive, and I learned a lot, and I made some lifelong friends, you know. And it was truly a mind-bending, opening, changing experience, because you learned about people a lot, you know, and about people and what they and what people think and what they do, and all the funny things, you know. It was truly, and then, you know, it was all a consciousness expansion movement, and it got thoroughly out of hand, you know. And things do, and you know, you come around to now, I mean, oh my God, you know what's going on now is really mind-bending, you know, thought bending and everything. It's heavy, you know, compared to even, I mean, the 60s were, though, I mean, from the beginning of the 60s to the end of the 60s was a really major change in how people think. And if you take somebody into like how things were in the beginning of the 60s, I mean, you couldn't walk into a store with long hair. You could, or you couldn't eat at a restaurant, you know, that was it. No matter how well dressed you were, you know, people had the right to just say, get out of here. It was really different than it is now. I mean, just being on the street and what a cop could do and all that. There was like a lot less rights. Rights are bad now, really crazy. And especially if you're if you're not white. I mean, I'm white, you know, it's easy for me, you know, it's super easy for me. I mean, if I were Hispanic, if I were Black, I'd be dead right now. Dead. Mm. I would have been in jail. I would have gone to jail for sure. You know, I would have, you know, you get out of jail, you can't get a job, you work for the family, you got your street cred. That's what you do. Come on, man. It's like a lifelong thing. And people get into it, and people like have had the attitude here of like, lock them up, throw away the key, lock them up, throw away the key. And it's inhumane. It destroys the entire family that person is centered with, you know, and it's just been aimed at a whole Black and Hispanic people, you know, flat out. And it's like my boss, John Burke, Trek Bikes, his son, interviewed him in a podcast that you can tune into, criticizing police unions in the United States. Big problem, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
Big problem for us. Those guys are like on the loose.
Yep, I'm with Trek Bikes, so that was the big deal, yeah?
Oh, well, it's a freaking nightmare, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what? You're doing what? You know? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but your warranty is void, you know? It's crazy, you know? And at the same time, you know, we had a lot of people that are saying, oh man, you got to support, you know, the law and order. These other people are out of hand. We can't have that stuff out of hand. And, you know, it's like, no, we can't have stuff out of hand, but it's sort of been a failure the way it's worked. Mm-hmm. And what are we protesting? Remember? And oh yeah, remember the old saying, the beatings will continue until morale improves. You know, it's like, come on, let's talk about this, you know, it's sort of wild, but no, we're not aware, you know, we're not like, but I will say, Wisconsin, Madison, I love it. Where track is and everything, but it is a bit of a bubble as far as, you know, and especially like, we're like, if you live in a nice neighborhood there and you're white, man, the cops are going to be so nice. You can't stand it. And it's the way it is here where I live. You know, the cops are super nice to me, you know, but man, if I were like Black or Hispanic, it's a different animal.
Yeah.
It's a totally different animal here. Where I live now, it's totally changing as far as like people that live here come from all over the world, you know, and that's a really good thing. And what's really funny, you know, about most of our countries, we have this big problem. Birth rate's super low. And we got nobody to take care of us old people. And it's bad in Japan, and it's going to get worse in the UK. It's going to get worse in the States. And why is that? Why is the birth rate so low? It's expensive to have a kid. And people want to have their careers. You know, it's like Silicon Valley companies will offer a good employee to freeze her eggs, you know, and because she wants to make a career, and then she wants to have her kids too, you know. And now we know that medical science at this moment is saying that 33 is when you start to, the fertility starts going south for a woman.
If you want to break into the bike trade, train your staff, or even learn some new skills just for fun, Cycle Systems Academy has a course for you. Our graduates come to us from all over the globe and train with us to gain the highest recognized cycle mechanic qualifications available. The bike industry supports and believes in Cycle Systems Academy, which means they'll believe in you too.
You know, let's get into the bike industry then.
And oh yeah, the bike industry.
And because it's, you know, bike racing and cycling as a kind of pastime and hobby has been a white guy thing, right? You know, for a long time, really. Yeah, yeah. So firstly, well, is that okay? Is there other, for some things that just white guys do? Or are the major problems and issues there that need addressing? And if so, how do you think the cycling community, for want of a better word, and the industry addresses it?
Well, the way we're doing it, going after it, is we do NICA, which is the National Interscholastic Cycling Association. And it's basically kids. We like to go down to middle school. So that's, you know, like 12-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, on up to like 18. And that thing is like growing like crazy because people love, well, it's mountain bike right at the moment. But I'm pushing a big initiative to do more inner city stuff and do more on the level of pump track. So you can bring like a 20-inch wheel bike, a 24-inch wheel bike, a scraper. You know what I'm saying? Like a really cheap bike. Because we have four problems, the four barriers to entry, that is. One, the bikes are expensive, okay? I talked to SRAM, I talked to Shimano. I say, look, we need a really super cheap, robust group, you know, that we can put on, make a cheap mountain bike that works. And cheap means that the thing lasts, because it's not cheap when it keeps breaking and it wears out all the time, you know, and it's unreliable. And so there's the cost of the bike. So it's met in a few ways. I mean, one is because it in the well-to-do neighborhoods, the kids ride carbon fiber bikes. It's crazy, you know. So second is they can't afford overnighters, you know, kids in inner city. And that's what all the kids have money. They go on overnighters. That's what's going on a lot now. Now the parents taking them out to a race. So the races have got to happen right there in the neighborhood. And then is the concussion. Concussion's an issue in a lot of schools in the States. And that's actually, they've done a pretty good job on that, because they have a protocol on you establish a baseline with the kids, and then you do testing and everything, and then they don't ride. And then you try to design a good course that doesn't make people crash. It's a lot of fun. You know, and that could be, and that's an art of the course. And I will say, there are more and more and more good course designer, mountain bike course designers worldwide than I could have ever imagined. I mean, it's so amazing. But okay, and then the fourth, okay, getting around to that, is we don't have enough coaches, when we have to recruit more people, so we have to do a better job of that. So those are really the things where I'd like to see get more inner city kids in the thing. And I think that's the basis, you know, the basics. The other is that I don't think you get a lot of, cycling as a sport is pretty famous, but man, nobody's making the big bucks like they do in baseball, or, you know, American baseball, American football and all that thing, or European football. Oh, so road racing's a mess. I think, you know, the way they, the way the money's divvied up with everybody, that's not really nice at all, not right at all. And the union that they have now is just sort of a token union.
Yeah.
Although they were really aggressive in, what was the stage the other day they truncated?
Yeah. In the Giro. Yeah. Stage 18 or something. But 18, I think, or 19. Yeah.
That was sort of amazing. But I'm hoping, you know, that people can put together a real union. That's the only way they're going to get anywhere. And I'm thinking the only ones that might do it for the ones that would do it first might be the women, because they tend to stick together better, you know, by nature, So it's
it's vulnerable too.
You know,
one thing that springs to mind when you talk about this, Gary, and talk about the Giro, is Teo Gugenhart that won the Giro. He started off with Cycle Club Hackney. Now, I know the founder of Cycle Club Hackney, a guy called Kia, and, you know, Kia is a great guy, but he's just a guy, you know, and I remember him saying to me, I'm going to start this cycle club for the youth in Hackney, because he was a youth worker. That's what he did, is he worked with kids who were from disadvantaged backgrounds and right. all the rest of it, and loved cycling. So he right. put the two together. And when we were based in London, when they started, we used to do maintenance courses for that club. And it was amazing to see this inner city youth, right. really diverse racially, you know, hanging out, talking about, as it was at the time, Alberto Contador and Andy Schleck. And they knew all of the stories, you know, and these were guys that normally would be into football, you know, and that was it pretty much, you know. So really, really exciting initiatives which can produce Grand Tour winners, started by just regular people, you know, like Kia right. with right. a passion. So anyone that's listening to this, you know, if you're inspired, you can, you know, do something amazing. You can change the world. It's just about starting it.
Well, there is a golden key. The golden key is the kids love it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to talk them into it. They want to come and do it. Mm-hmm. And the parents love it because they say, my kid was a mess. And now my kids got focus. Because, well, in the States, it's a lot of it centered around being a good student athlete. And, you know, it's a lot of kids are, you know, too hyper, right? And this straightens them out. And we have all the medical evidence now. And not only makes them happy, but it makes them study better. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's another really incredible part about the whole program. And, you know, so that's really, that's on one level, you know, what we want to do. I mean, personally, I want to do the moonshot and say, hey, in 10 years, I want to have a black winner of the Tour de France.
Yeah, well, you that's know, crazy. Back in the 60s, they used to say you're part of the yeah. problem or you're part of the solution. I've got to say, cycling's got to be part of the solution. You know, we're talking about radical social change that we know we need for the survival of the race. I mean, someone said the other day, it shouldn't be a radical stance for survival of the species, you know, that should be the baseline.
And yeah, but having, you know, it comes back to like recent scientific evidence. I mean, over the last 300 years, there's been amazing, you know, transformation, because it used to be, you know, who told you who you are, where you came from, what your purpose is, and where you're going. Who told you that? That was your local priest, right? And then came along this scientist, and they had a telescope, they had a microscope, and they started upsetting things. And it's still in a process. And there was a notion that people that have black skin or dark skin are inferior, you know, and like it still has, you know, weirdness. I mean, it's like I go to Southeast Asia and I'm in Thailand, and you know, about 30% of the women, it's hot as all blazes, and they're wearing long tights, you know, like black, you know, over their legs and their arms. Why is that? They don't want to look too tan, you know. So there's all this weirdness that's going on, the racehorse theory, and it's been totally debunked, right? It's like, you know, I'm a white boy. I did 23andMe. I'm 57.5% from Northern England. My mother says, oh, you're Swedish. You're Swedish. I'm 2.5% Swedish. This goes back 40,000 years. My mother went back 400 years. If we go back 150,000 years, we all came from Africa. And, you know, it's like science says now, you want to mix stuff up. It's healthy. When I was a kid, I mean, in the 50s, I mean, a kid who was interracial, oh, that was unusual to somebody, right? And now it's like, wow, let's see the combo. Cool. Right? You know? And that's the way it really works. So you got people that are things is still in the States believing that, like in this old racehorse theory thing, I mean, our president. It's like a mind blower, you know, and it's like that's old, you know, old technology. You know, it's just like old science.
Yeah, right. I mean, we're seeing it in the UK too, you know, where British people, there's a certain sector of society where looking back to the days of the empire,
right,
going, well, this was Great Britain and we want to be like this, you know. Yeah. But
that's gone forever, you know. That's it. It's like it's gone. I know exactly what you're talking about there. Mm. You know, it's gone.
But if we come back onto the mountain bike, you know, try and come full circle with it, I wanted to get into the, because we're talking about evolution of society really and the bike's role in it. But in terms of the evolution of the mountain bike, the mountain bike obviously is a freedom tool, and it started off racing. So I saw, you know, Charlie Kelly, your old friend and co-conspirator, he was on Facebook, I think 4 days ago, three days ago, and said it was 44 years ago to the day that we had the first ever repack race on Mount Tamalpais, you know. And, you know, so the start of mountain biking was the racing, the downhill racing.
Racing, it gets the focal, you know, it gets people excited about things. That's mm-hmm. what it does, you know, more than anything, and events like that and everything. And you got to realize too, though, like a lot of like the, you know, the goodness of the mountain bike was the fact that these places existed and nobody was out there. Hmm. And this was the way of going and exploring those places. I mean, the first bikes that we made were basically heavy duty road bikes, you know, with big clearances and things. And then other people were doing it. I mean, like in the UK, you had Jeff Apps. I mean, I was totally unaware of him. And then I was aware of him. You know, we subscribed to the, well, I was a subscriber. I was already a subscriber since I was a kid of British Cycling, you know, the weekly.
Yeah.
And in British Cycling Weekly, one day we're looking in there and it's like, Rough Stuff Fellowship, let's join. Mm-hmm. I joined. And then, you know, Charlie did an article for them. We exchanged stuff. I saw Jeff Apps' article in there and it's like, wow, these guys are doing it. And I got tires. I got 700C and 650B tires from Jeff. It was really cool, you know, and built bikes, you know, 10 700C bikes and six 650B. But the problem was those tires from Finland were going to cost $120 US retail. And at the time, you could get a 26 by 2125 Unirail knobby tire for $11.95 in any bike shop in the United States. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It was, you know, I couldn't make a bike that didn't take standards. And I wanted to make a bike that had really standards, you know. But what we did with the thing, and I did with the thing, was three things. Publicize it like crazy. Had a good design, publicize it like crazy. And the good design was that it was all a recognized good stuff standards. It was, and at the time it was like English Campagnolo dimensions. And indeed, of course I'd use Campagnolo parts if I could on it. And I did. And of course I used Shimano Dura Ace. And of course I used dual wood sealed bearings. I had to use and make a really expensive bike. The bike we had, the very first model bike we had, was the Everest, and a fillet braised frame, and it was $1,320. And then we customized it on that from then. And at that moment, you could get from Colnago a full Campagnolo bike for $450. And that was cheap because Campagnolo at that time would pay their teams in groups, you know, instead of cash. And then the teams would sell them for whatever money they could get. And it made a mess of Campagnolo's pricing. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that's why Colnago had such an incredible deal. But you could buy a Ben Sirota for $995, a full custom, full campy bike. Beautiful bike. And our bike started at $1,320. And we sold a ton of them. It was crazy, you know, because they were beautiful, you know. And everything was super high quality. So The first bikes were just sort of like oversized road bikes. And then we got into suspension and index shifting. And now the bikes, it's so crazy. And the geometry has changed. More has changed in the mountain bike. You know, the geometry for sure in the last 5 years than in the 30 years previous to that, because people would get so locked in, you know, to their dogma, you know, what's supposed to be good. And now it's like there's all these crazy dimensions out there available. And, you know, you go out to the outer edges and you come back, you know, oh, it's like the Grim Donut. That's like the guys at Pink Bike are doing, you know, that bike. It's sort of radical. Yeah. It's like ridiculous, you know. You learn from ridiculous and then you come back to something more, you know, why you're doing it and everything. But I like the fact that like you can buy these road bikes that have the ability to fit a 40 millimeter tire, you know, and the tire is available. It's crazy. You know, I love it. And then you can get a mountain bike that's, you know, you can go to way too fat to something, you know, well, it's hard to find a narrow mountain bike tire now, you know. It's funny. You go, you say, well, what do you need that for? Why don't you put that in your road bike? You know what I'm saying? And then the mountain bikes with suspension, the suspension works really well, you know, compared to what we had even 10 years ago or 5 years ago, as far as it does what it's supposed to do. And it not only does it suck up bumps, but it makes you more efficient. You know, it's amazing. And you can pedal, you know, it's amazing, you know. And then the whole thing with courses and what guys do on the downhill and enduro scene. And then the guys that do just do the tricks and the jumps and stuff just blow my mind. You know, the whole, you know, first they were jumping into lakes and then they jumped into foam and now they're jumping into airbags and stuff like that. You've seen them make any soft sort of hills and landing spots and things, or like a ramp that comes down, but it's all sort of soft material. So if they fall in it, it's no big deal and everything. It's crazy.
Yeah. The branches of the tree from the acorn that you planted are, you know, so varied now, so varied. And it's amazing, isn't it, to see, as you say, the whole gravel bike thing with people going back to a bike that's pared down,
right,
without as much technology, just for getting out into the hills again.
Oh yeah, no, it's nice. Well, it's a, you know, and we went back to the one by, you know, more simplicity, which you know, I really like in a lot of ways. You know, you don't think about it as much all the time. You know, there's plenty to think about in like what's up the road, what's left in your legs and your heart and everything, you know, and pacing it out and going through the ride and everything. But road racing, television is primitive. And you look at mountain bike television, it's not. Mm-hmm. And you look at other sports television, it's not the embarrassment that you have an announcer, you know, presenter, and he's getting the same information you are, the visual, and the visual is not accurate, you know, and their timing is not accurate. It's such a joke, you know, and it's one of these days somebody's going to come along and blow these guys away, you know, and they're using helicopters and they should be using drones, you know, and a drone is illegal by the UCI. It's like, ugh. Come on, you guys. Mm-hmm. You know, in a way, the whole women's thing, they're gonna get taken to court on that one. That one's like crazy because they don't get the exposure time. They are given these races that, you know, you, from an outsider, you look at it and go like, well, they're doing the wimpy course. You know, they're doing the shortened course. You know, seriously shortened. I mean, I know bike racing, and I know a short race can be harder than a long race. That's for sure, because it's, you know, it can be pegged the whole way. I'm not, but you know, they should make the races the same length because it's all about respect. You know, You see, good women are tough. I mean, you know, they look beautiful from time to time and everything, and they are beautiful, you know, throughout their soul. But my God, you think you're tough. No.
Yeah, well, here's the day where, yeah. I mean, anyone listening to this or, you know, watching the Giro, irrespective of race or gender or any of that, should be able to have the same dream, right? They should be able to dream that they can get up there and do it. And
well, it happened. I mean, look, I mean, mountain bike, women ride the same course on the downhill and in the cross country and everything, you know, and they're more, at least the time is more there, you know, and it's always been that with triathlon, same way, you know, same course, same prizes. It's supposed to be that way, you know. Trek has done that. We've done that with the cyclocross. We do it with, especially in the Nika and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to treat it at least fairly, you know. It's the whole thing is, it's all got to change, you know. It will on the roadside. It'll change. It has to change just because that's the vulnerability. They just can't see their way out of the box. You know, it's like, I don't like the way they shortened that stage the other day, but I like, it is true. I mean, that was a totally stupid, senseless stage.
Yeah.
You know, and the transfer times and all that sort of thing, all that stuff counts like crazy. You know, it's a, you know, some riders in the tour, I know like Lance, we'd get a helicopter, you know? And that's a total advantage. You're not spending an extra hour or two in the bus, you know? You're like relaxing and not stressing, being jerked around in the bus. All that stuff counts. I mean, all the incremental things besides what the other pharmaceuticals. But every single one of those counts, right? And the fact you have a really good doctor and all that. Ugh.
Yeah, I do believe... Chris Boardman, when he was racing, availed himself of the Rolling Stones helicopter a few times because they're big cycling fans, those guys, and big cyclists. Yeah. Well, coming back to the book then, Gary. So we've been teasing people saying this book's coming. When's it coming out? When can people get hold of it?
It's being shipped right now. You know, the first printing, but I think the first printing, I think we were conservative. We're going to be selling it to, you know, we sell in about 100 countries, and we're just going to distribute it through Trek.
Yep.
And, you know, and I know they're going to reorder more, but it's, there's already, you know, I know there's 100 in the UK right now.
Amazing. Right now. Well, I can't wait to get hold of it. Although I'm in Switzerland right now. I'm not in the UK right now, but, don't know how many copies are over here, but can't wait to get my hands on it. And
it's just people, like, they look at it, they grab it, they go, they just can't put it down because it's like every page is different, really different, you know. And it's a beautiful piece because it's these Blue Train Publishing. They do a lot of the books for Rafa, and they're the best. They know their paper, their printing, their binding. It's bound in a particularly bizarre manner. Everybody that worked on this project said, okay, I'm gonna like go over the top. We said, okay, you can go over the top, there's no barriers. And like they did, you know. I mean, that's sort of that concept can really fail because you can have something that's like mismatched and sort of ugly, but they all got behind the whole theme, the whole thing. And it's just like page by page, there's a lot there. It's not just a story, you know, and the story is more about a trend, you know, and my family is crazy, you know, what we've done. And it's sort of like, I'm not done. You know, I always have that attitude, and I really feel like these next few years are going to be really important because there can be a lot of change, or we could backslide. You know, like crazy. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, the next couple of weeks, the next week, you know, it's clearly a thing that people got to turn up.
Yeah.
Spend the time.
And for anyone listening to this 6 months down the line, Gary and I are speaking, what, 10 days before the US election?
That's right. That's right. So it's insane times, man. Who knows what's going to happen, you know? It's wild. Yeah, well,
at least you got a chance to make a difference. So fingers crossed there.
Oh, we got a big, big chance. A huge, huge chance, you know? Yeah. And it's also, though, you know, we've already seen the difference and the change. You've seen it. Everybody's seen it. They've seen people's behaviors change because, you know, I mean, what's the hardest thing to change? The gray matter between the ears. Once you change that, everything else is easy. And you know, that's how it works. You know, change, you know, we're emotional beings, you know, and that's it. Emotion rules and facts are inflated and deflated to fit emotion. And that's the way humans work. The book, I talk a lot about humanity, you know, and that affects what happens, you know, it really does. And that's my point, you know, it's like more than anything, that's my point. And I guess my boss, he said, Gary, you got to write the book. He's like, oh, my case. You know, you got to write the book. You got to write the book. Because you'd hear these stories and I'd tell him stories and he's like, holy shit, you know, all this stuff. But I didn't want the thing to just be a list of parties and stupid things, you know. It just doesn't make sense because I got really strong feelings for a reason. Well, that's all.
I really can't, as I say, I just can't wait to get into it. So I'm going to find out where I can get it here in Bern, where I am right now, before I get back to the UK. And if you're listening, go and search the book. Best off Trek dealers or bookstores?
It'll be Trek dealers, I believe, you know, but our offices are in Zurich. We have an office there.
Cool. Okay. Well, I'll be there on Wednesday. So. I'll go check that out.
Go check.
Okay, well, if you needed any more encouragement, go and get down to your local Trek dealer and check out Being Gary Fisher and the Bicycle Revolution. Gary, thanks so much for joining us for your morning, and good luck with everything in your world and in the USA, and look forward to catching up soon.
Excellent. And hey, you take care of yourself, and we're going to see you on the other side, right?
Yeah.
Got it.
Cool. Thanks for listening, everyone.
All right. Bye now.